Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of January. Senator Russ Feingold joins us the first half hour of our program during our 9 o'clock hour today. There's a very interesting journal titled Democracy, a Journal of Ideas, and their winter 2013 issue is devoted to everyone's fight. They talk about the presidential campaign we just went through, the first to cost more than $2 billion. The first time neither candidate accepted any public financing or the limits that come with it, and the first presidential election after Citizens United. Senator Feingold wrote an article that appears in this journal titled Building a Permanent Majority for Reform. He says in the wake of the Supreme Court's lawless decision in Citizens United, it's clear that corruption is alive and well in our political system. And he calls for us to confront that corruption, and he will talk about how, while he is on the air. He, of course, represented Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate from 1993 to 2011, was co-author of McCain-Feingold, and also the founder of Progressives United. His latest book is While America Sleeps, A Wake-Up Call for the Post-9/11 Era. We'll welcome phone calls for him. Call in early. He gets a lot of calls when he's on the air, and the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you would like to send us messages that way, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We should also say he just started teaching law at Stanford this winter. Senator Feingold, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's good to be on again, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. You have called the past election one in which there was a lot of corrupt money that was floating around. How do you identify corrupt money? Where is it coming from? What is it?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know, and that's because the case of Citizens United by the Supreme Court, after basically 100 years of not allowing corporations to use their treasuries for contributions, basically opened the floodgates. And they did not. We do not have a law in the country requiring the disclosure of those kinds of contributions. So what they did was allow unlimited contributions without disclosure, without knowing who the heck these contributions are from. It's technically illegal that they be from foreign entities, but when you're dealing with corporations, they're obviously multinational corporations, and the money's fungible. Not to mention, who knows what kind of conversations are going on that involve, huge amounts of money because there are no limits. The way I like to say, Kathleen, is, you know, we obviously say in Wisconsin, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Mm-hmm. I would say there's also no such thing as a free $10 million contribution. It's obviously going to be corrupt in nature, and that's what's going on, but it has to be uncovered.
$2 billion for a presidential election. Where in the world did all that money go?
That's another good question. You know, people focus on who won the election. Understandably, they focus, as I just did, on the corruption aspect of who gave the money and what they're getting for it. But you just asked a really good question that almost nobody asks is, where does the money go? Well, among the places, obviously, is huge media corporations and others that are able to run these TV ads. But there's another, in some ways, even more sinister and hidden thing. That's these consultants, especially in Washington and New York, these folks who make a fortune telling people, you know, give us all this money and we'll figure out for you how to win the election. The symbol of this is the dissembling by Karl Rove on Fox News on the night of the election. I absolutely believe he made a fortune off of these super PACs and being a consultant. And he was spinning it, you know, let it well into the evening that Romney was still going to win. And what you could see here is it's really a flim-flam thing where people are making a huge amount of money because our democracy is being mutilated by unlimited contributions, and somebody's making money off of it, and it's not us.
Mm-hmm. You write in this piece that you're confident that a new Supreme Court with justices appointed by President Obama will recognize that corruption exists. So why don't we just wait until we get the new Supreme Court justices, and then it will be fixed, won't it?
Well, we don't have control over when there'll be vacancies on the Supreme Court. Yes, I do hope this president gets to appoint a couple of people, and there was only one vote. And I think you know, I've been teaching law both at Marquette in Milwaukee and here at Stanford where I am right now. And the academic attitude about this decision is almost universal, that it was a terrible decision. Having said that, you're right, we can't just do nothing and wait. And our organization, Progressives United, is about informing people about how the decision could be overturned. But in the meantime, we can make sure that things will help us prove the case. And number one is requiring the disclosure, the public disclosure of these contributions. That means passing a federal disclosure act, which I had the opportunity to help author when I was in the Senate. They need to get 60 votes to break the filibuster on that, that require the contributions. But also at the state level, in states that don't require disclosure, there's a movement in many states to require that kind of disclosure, including in California, where they're just a vote or two short of what they need. So once these contributions get out in the open, the corruption or the scandal that I am certain is occurring right now will come out, and everybody will say, well, why didn't anybody tell us this was going on? We had no way to know. But if you pass these pieces of legislation, which we can do now, and the Supreme Court actually said that's appropriate, then that's a way we can push not only the public's knowledge of this, but I think create a record that the Supreme Court can say, look, this really is corruption.
The past election, you talk about the fact that Democrats who wanted to build a mandate for reform instead took a big step back. You are unhappy that they succumbed to what you call a new campaign finance order. Why did Democrats do that? Is it virtually impossible to win a race unless you play along with these new rules, Senator Feingold?
Absolutely not. You know, in 1998, people demanded that I take soft money contributions when I ran for reelection. And, you know, I just refused because I just didn't think it made any sense for me, somebody who believes in this kind of reform, to say, oh, it doesn't apply to me. And I managed to win. It was close, but I managed to win. But, you know, here's a situation. If we really remember a year ago, I'm so thrilled the president won and looking forward to his being inaugurated again. People forget that a year ago, people thought he was in deep trouble. And I think the White House was nervous. And unfortunately, they went against what I think are the president's good instincts on this and said, look, we got to win this election or we won't be able to reform any. So they decided to go ahead and do this game of using super PACs, as did many congressional campaigns. You know, I don't think that's why President Obama won, because of super PAC. I think he won because of who he is and because Romney did such an awful job of associating himself with a very narrow sliver of America against the rest of us. So I think it was a big mistake for us to sort of get in this game. We're not going to have Barack Obama to run next time. And so, you know, we need to have a situation where we have a message. It is about us being on the side of the average person. It doesn't work when you're taking enormous hidden contributions from Wall Street and Exxon and BP and all these companies to try to claim that you're really on the side of working people. And I think that's a fundamental strategic mistake, not to mention that, as I've already said, I think it's very corrupting of our system of government.
So you think that candidates, to be above the fray here, to be appearing as honest and to be honest brokers, need to not take any of this money?
Right, clearly. I mean, nobody took it before this year. Mm-hmm. The last couple campaigns was never allowed since 1907. So it's perfectly possible for somebody to run for office and say, I'm not taking hidden, you know, corporate contributions. I'm not going to have groups set up that will do that. And Kathleen, the key here is not just who wins election. The conversation, understandably, tends to be, you know, who won? Look, we won anyway. What's
right.
The problem? Well, here's the problem. The problem is what happens afterward. If both parties are taking these kinds of huge contributions from the same companies, BP, Exxon, whatever it is, what do you get in the end? Well, it doesn't matter so much who wins the election. The big corporate interests will win either way. And that's what we saw in the 1990s when the soft money contributions to the parties were being sucked up by both parties. This is what McCain-Feingold was all about. It banned those soft money contributions to the parties, and that's still the law. That is still good law. What happened before we passed that law was trade agreements were passed that sent many of our Wisconsin manufacturing jobs overseas. Both parties voted for it. We got rid of a lot of independent radio in the Telecommunications Act of 1996, where only five people voted against it. Both parties were bought off by the media giants. And of course, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the key to making sure Wall Street wouldn't run loose. Only 8 of us voted against that. Both parties, frankly, especially Democrats, are sucking up huge amount of Wall Street money. And so the point here is it's not so much who won, it's who already bought off the whole process and what do you get afterward. That's the most important aspect of this issue that isn't emphasized enough.
You mentioned the 1998 race where you didn't take any of this money. You made a lot of your supporters, though, Senator Feingold, a bit nervous because they weren't sure you were going to win that race. And as you said, it was a close race. That's not always going to play out in various races around the country, is it? A lot of people might lose.
Yeah, I mean, you might lose sometimes if you don't play by dirty rules. But, you know, I noticed that the attitude people had about my role in the Senate after that was greatly enhanced. Mm. People didn't just say, oh, he's another guy, he managed to win, he's another politician. People said, wow, he took the risk of losing his seat in order to make this point. And I tell you, it's the reason we were able, one of the main reasons we were able to pass McCain-Feingold is because people saw that the people like me felt so strongly about this corrupting influence of soft money that we were willing to risk our seat. That's the, you know, to me, that's a test of leadership in our society, is that what are you willing to do that would risk causing you to lose. Winning really isn't everything. What's the point of being in office if you're not willing to stand for something? And this is an issue that I really believe is fundamental to our democracy.
You look at the number of television commercials, or at least we had to look at a lot of television commercials in Wisconsin being a swing state, and you think this has gone beyond the point of any kind of return. How in the world can people not tune them out after you're running like 4 minutes straight, one for one candidate, one for another, and then you go back and run another ad for the first candidate and another one? It seems to me as though there must have been a whole lot of wasted money.
That's, and you're absolutely right about that. And that goes back to my overall point here. We have too narrow of a way of looking at this issue of campaign money. We go, wow, you know, this a lot of money, and who won the election? You're getting at the real issues here. Who got the money? And isn't it being wasted? And what happens afterward? You know, people get inundated with these ads. Both sides have gotten money from many of the same big corporate interests. It's an absurdity. But what happens in the end is that those companies are running the show, and they have the feeling of obligation from members of both parties who are in Congress and in the state legislatures. So, yeah, in many ways, these ads are pointless, but at the same time, they are the product of the way in which this decision by the Supreme Court is allowing corporate interests to basically strangle our democracy, and that by numbing people, making them feel that it doesn't matter, that's part of the way it has a numbing effect.
The journal where your article appears, Democracy, a Journal of Ideas, says that the government reform movement is woefully underfunded and understaffed in the battle against groups like the Chamber of Commerce. What kind of government reform movement funding is necessary, and who makes up the government reform movement right now?
Well, you know, that's been one of the good developments since Citizens United, is that there are a number of groups that already existed that are really looking at this issue, such as MoveOn.org and the DFA, Democracy for America. Of course, Common Cause has long been involved in this and worked with me very closely on McCain-Feingold, and they're all working on this issue. Now, I've created a group that is specific to this issue called Progressives United, and to give you an example, we've been able to grow our list from when I left the Senate dramatically. Our average contribution, by actually hundreds of thousands of people, our average contribution for this online and this effort to overturn the decision and get disclosure laws has been something like $50. And so what I'm finding is that there is a great deal of interest in fighting this. And the important thing is not the money, is that we have this very large number of people who we can say, look, we think that there's not been enough enforcement on the people who created the problems on Wall Street. We want you to email and demand the president to do something about it. Well, we find that we can get tens of thousands of emails in very quickly, in a few hours, to fight a battle that is the result of the unlimited money in politics. So I think there's a lot of activism, even to the point where some people say, hey, how do I figure out which group to support? But that's usually a good sign. The other thing is, I noticed that legislators and almost every state are now coming up with ideas about campaign finance, whether it's public financing. And in New York, we're trying to get the New York City system to apply to the whole state of New York. In other states, people are saying, let's create some changes in the nature of corporate governance. Let's give shareholders a way to block companies from getting involved in this kind of game, this unlimited money. So that's another thing I noticed as a legislator. When everybody's proposing an idea in an area, that means it's reaching critical mass. So I think because of the way you can raise funds from small amounts of money over the Internet and the general concern about this, that this is going to become better from a funding point of view.
Senator Russ Feingold, who was senator representing the state of Wisconsin from 1993 to 2011, he's the founder of Progressives United, and he is teaching at Marquette and also at Stanford in their law school. He wrote an interesting piece. We direct your attention to it in the winter issue of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. Here's our phone number. We're going to take some phone calls, and we have a couple of emails that have come in. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and we have put a link of Senator Feingold's article on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and also on Twitter, which is, what the heck is that Twitter thing? At K Dunn Show. I got to get with it in 2013. Got to get with the times. Phone calls for Senator Feingold in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second part of this hour, we talked about the enormous amount of money. What happens to that money? What is the influence that you have once you've paid that amount of money to a candidate? We'll have two guests with us, an associate professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which does track political ads in top races across the country. And we'll speak with the editorial director of Sunlight Foundation Reporting. Their mission is using the power of the Internet to catalyze greater government openness. Senator Russ Feingold is our guest right now. Let's start with an email that's come in from Bob in Waukesha. Senator Feingold, since Citizens United will only be overturned if the court personnel changes, who do you see as possibly leaving the court during Obama's second term?
Well, first let me say I should have mentioned the Sunlight Foundation. It's one of those groups that's been so active in this kind of issue. I'm glad you're having somebody on from their group. We're trying to have everybody work together. Well, in terms of the court, obviously there's a couple of ways people can leave the court. One of them is out of our hands and up the higher authorities, and we never know what will happen with that. Sometimes when I say it only takes one vote, people say, well, our people are sicker than their people who voted on the Citizens United case.
Right.
But, you know, the fact is that you never know. People sometimes just retire, as Justice Souter did. And so, you know, people say that now some of the older Democrats might feel comfortable, or people that were appointed by Democrats might feel comfortable retiring because President Obama is president. So there may be a replacement there. That wouldn't change the court. The key here would be if one of the five people who was in the 5-4 majority either resigned or left the court for some other reason or changed their mind. And, you know, I'm not saying they will. All I can say is this decision has been so devastating to the reputation of the Supreme Court. Many, many leading legal scholars believe it's one of the four or five worst decisions in the history of the United States Supreme Court, a terrible decision from a legal point of view. There was no reason for the court to rule in this way because you could have had a very narrow decision that simply said this movie about Hillary Clinton wasn't covered by the law, which it wasn't. I wrote the bill, so I know that it wasn't intended to do that. But the court overreached and was very activist in a way that conservatives should be appalled by, and essentially wiped out a law signed by Teddy Roosevelt in 1907, over 100 years ago, that said corporations shouldn't be able to do this. So we just have to be ready. The opportunity could occur at any moment to get a new justice, and that could change this whole thing. But as I indicated, you can't just have that strategy. There are many other things we can do, including legislation on not only disclosure, but getting rid of the Federal Elections Commission that doesn't work and replacing it with a better one, and fighting for, you know, public financing of House and Senate races that's never occurred, the presidential funding system. doesn't work anymore. So there are a lot of things we can do while we wait to see if a vacancy or two will occur on the Supreme Court.
Liz in Fitchburg. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Morning, Senator Feingold. I have a question about the approval rating of the Congress, the United States Congress and Senate. I heard the other day that most Americans would rather have a colonoscopy now than have anything to do with the Congress. And I've had a colonoscopy, and it's not very comfortable. So I was wondering what you thought about this poor approval rating and what can be done about it.
Yeah, well, I saw that survey. That was one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen. I'll tell you what I think can be done about it. People say, you know, should we change the rules of the Senate? In fact, I taught a course at Marquette Law School. I'm teaching one at Stanford now about, you know, how the Senate works and its rules and how it fits in with the Constitution. But you know what? You can change the rules all you want. It's up to the people to say, we're tired of this. And here's what people should be demanding. Instead of demanding 100% purity on either side of the aisle, or some of these Tea Party people basically say, if you ever vote against us, you're done. We'll run a primary against you. People should start jumping up and down demanding that people work together, that the Democrats and Republicans prove that they've worked together. So what I've been saying lately is reminds me of when John McCain and I first started working together in some issues. I went to a town meeting, wherever it was, I think it was Wapaka County or somewhere, and I said to everybody, hey, I'm doing a bill with John McCain. And people started cheering wildly, because they knew he was a conservative Republican, I was a progressive Democrat. And I said, wait a minute, how do you know it's not a bill to prohibit the dairy industry? And everybody laughed. But the point was, the pressure then in the 90s was to work together. So I think people should go up to candidates and say, you know, I'm going to vote for you, but if you don't come back next time you're running and prove to me that you work with a member of the other party and got something done, I'm not going to vote for you again. That is the way that politicians will respond. They don't really want to be nasty to each other, usually, but they're afraid of having a primary from somebody who's more extreme than them. So I think that the answer is mostly with the people.
Thanks, Liz, very much for the call. Robin in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Robin.
Hi there. I want to say thank you, Mr. Feingold. It's been wonderful having you in Wisconsin. I really wish you could still be here. I noticed you've been working with McCain, and in the past he was a very common sense man, but when he ran for president, he seemed to have changed, not for the better. And I know you like to be in a position where you can make a change. Would you ever moonlight the idea of running for president, or are you afraid it might change you?
Well, you know, I'm just not very interested in that sort of a process. It seems so all-consuming, and I enjoyed being a legislator. I'm enjoying teaching and thinking about some of these ideas and advocating. It's not a fear of it. It's just I don't know if that's the right kind of thing for me, nor do I really think that I could just run for president. I think that there are other people lining up to do that, and I'm very happy with the president we have right now.
And finally, you speak with a lot of members of Congress and have friendships with a number of senators. Have they had enough with all of this trying to raise money? I would think that it would be tedious, that it would be something you would just get sick of.
Oh, it's horrible. They hate it. And they've always hated it. I mean, it's, you know, you talk about whining. 80% of the whining that goes on in Washington has to do with having to raise money. And, of course, one of the most ridiculous things about this new system is it's supposedly independent. These corporate and unlimited contributions are supposedly independent of politicians. That's a pretty sleazy aspect of this. It's not really very independent. There's a lot of back and forth going on that puts a lot of pressure on members of Congress to sidle up to people that have huge amounts of money in the hope that others will ask them for those contributions. So it's disgusting. People hate it. It was one of the reasons we were able to pass McCain-Feingold, is even of the conservative Republicans who never supported campaign finance just got sick and tired of it. Thad Cochran of Mississippi was the last vote we needed to get 60. He just came up to John McCain in 2000 and said, John, I'm sick and tired of this system. So, yeah, and of course, it's a frightening system for members of Congress, not to mention challengers, because you can have this wall of money coming at you. You don't even know who it's from. And it makes it very hard for somebody campaigning to get their message out. How do you get your message out against this massive amount of secret spending?
Senator Feingold, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you on the air.
Again.
Senator Russ Feingold, former U.S. Senator from Wisconsin for a number of years, founder of Progressives United, which is a political action committee opposing corporate influence in the United States political system, and author of, I think this is the last time we talked to him, on his book, While America Sleeps, a wake-up call for the post-9/11 era. So he mentioned the amount of money and the past presidential election, $2 billion was spent, which I think almost everybody has to say, what? $2 billion? Why was so much money spent? What happened to all of that money? How influential is money when it comes to setting policy? Our guests in the next part of the program will be answering those questions. Professor Michael France is Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads in top races across the country. Professor France, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And also joining us is Bill Allison, and Bill is the editorial director for Sunlight Foundation Reporting. That organization is using the power of the internet to catalyze greater government openness and transparency, and also providing tools for the media and for citizens alike. Bill, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start with this money, this $2 billion, which is so much money in the presidential race. And let's go to you first, Michael France. Where did all of that money go? You've tracked some of that. Where did it go?
Well, a substantial amount of it actually went to TV advertising. So TV ads are typically a major source of any competitive elections budget. And this time around, with the extent of advertising that came from super PACs in this race, they spent a substantial percentage of their own budgets on TV ads. There's been a lot of talk about the transition in campaigns from these sort of broadly targeted TV campaigns to more narrow targeted and micro targeted ground games, and that definitely did happen. But TV was still sort of the big behemoth here in terms of what ate up a huge portion of a lot of these candidates and groups' budgets.
And do we have any idea of knowing, either Bill or Michael, if this money does what it's supposed to do? Does it get somebody elected?
Boy, you know, we did a look at some of the bigger groups, the American Crossroads and so on, and, you know, the super PACs really had a mixed record in this time. A lot of the conservatives didn't do particularly well. We looked at, you know, especially for congressional races, where they were spending money and did they get the desired result. And some of these groups had a return on investment of, you know, less than 1%. In other words, you know, that for every $99 they spent, they only, you know, had one candidate that came through, or they only spent $1 on a candidate that came through for them. So they, you know, in that sense, it you know, if you're looking at who won and who lost. But the flip side is, if you think about elections which are national events, and you have, you know, the congressional parties and the you know, and different candidates raising money and putting demands on the party infrastructure, in some ways I think it can really have an effect where you can make somebody who would be 10 points down, maybe only 5 points down, you may make an incumbent sweat a little bit more. And in that sense, you know, it definitely does have an impact.
Mm-hmm. Is it, though, enough of a negative outcome here that this election would make a lot of the players, those who spent a lot and those who didn't spend a lot, sit down and say, this system seems to be kind of broken?
Boy, you know, not from what I've seen. I mean, you know, I think that a lot of the folks who are in this are political pros. They used to work, you know, an awful lot of them used to work for the political parties or ran campaigns.
Right.
And they see this as being, you know, basically a full-time ongoing thing that they're going to be, you know, that the law allows them to do this. And as long as they can find the donors, they're going to continue to do this. And, you know, we've already seen organizations being set up or spending money to get involved in the, you know, the Chuck Hagel nomination for Secretary of Defense.
Really?
Spending money, yes. So it's not as if these organizations are going away. And in fact, you know, what you might see is them spending money year round to try to influence, you know, the government.
So people, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say also that the money will in the election season itself will probably shift to other types of expenditures next time around. So I think on the conservative side, there's still going to be plenty of donors who are going to want to try to tip the Senate or maintain control of the House, and they're going to try to be persuaded, I think, by these organizations to invest in new types of campaigns that will be less focused, perhaps, on TV and probably more focused on that ground stuff that we did here that the Obama campaign did so well. There's going to be a lot about voter targeting, sophisticated use of data mining of registered voters, and donors are going to probably see groups doing those types of things and are going to invest to try to increase turnout and so forth.
Hmm. So going back to Hagel for a moment, because I found that very interesting, we're going to see those who support his nomination run television ads and those who are opposed to it?
There's already a group that has ads on the internet. And they were around in the 2010 and 2012 elections, the Emergency Committee for Israel, and they've been running ads against some internet ads questioning Hagel's background, his beliefs, his views, and one of his Hagel's former aides is putting together an organization now and trying to raise money to counteract that. So, we may be seeing on television. Chances are most of these things would run in Washington because they'd be targeted at just 100 viewers. The senators will be deciding an up or down vote on the nomination. But we've seen that, and then there's another thing that we've seen which we haven't seen before. The Obama campaign is still actively raising money, and they just put out an ad a couple of last week. My colleague Kathy Kiley was writing about it. It was about a 2.5-minute internet ad that talked about the coming to a conclusion to the fiscal cliff deal and keeping a promise and raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans that he had said he wanted to do in the campaign. And at the end of it, it asks you to donate to the campaign, and you click on that link, and it says, for the next 4 years, support the president for the next 4 years, and it has like a whole bunch of different levels of donations. You can give up to $1,000. So this is somewhat unprecedented, and there's a question as to what's going to happen to Obama for America campaign. Is it going to become a C4? Is it going to keep on going? Or a nonprofit that doesn't disclose its donors, but can be politically active? So, we are in a brave new world in terms of raising money and spending money to influence politics.
Well, it's all kind of weird, isn't it? Because you look at, we were talking about the latest poll that shows that Congress is about as popular as a colonoscopy, which makes you wonder, why are they even doing any of this when all the people that they're trying to get to give them money, many of them don't even like them. They don't like Congress. They don't like the whole system.
I keep going back to what Mark Hanna said, that when you think about politicians or politics, that there's two important things. The first one is money, and I can't remember what the second one is. And so popularity isn't that important, but having a lot of money in the bank is.
Yeah. Senator Feingold was talking about trying to get enough votes to pass a federal disclosure act, so at least we would have some idea of who's collecting all of that money. Do either of you see that as a possibility, and how strong are the efforts to get that passed?
Well, it's probably not a significant possibility. I think there's a little bit of rumblings on the Republican side about Lisa Murkowski recently came out in favor of a disclosure bill. She's not exactly a Republican, I suppose, but anymore. But she sort of is a vote that Democrats need in order to get closer to the 60 in order to pass something. I don't see it as significantly possible given the House and its control of Republicans. If it were to sort of be the major effort that was pushed by campaign reform advocates, it would be useful to voters, perhaps, and it's critical to sort of our democratic process. But there's so many obstacles in the way of getting that thing passed through Congress, especially given how political some of the different elements of a proposed disclosure bill are. And so, I don't have high hopes for that, but it's something that people need to keep pushing for. And if the public were to get behind it, it would be hard for members of Congress to consistently resist it. But that's sort of been one of the stumbling blocks.
Yeah. Do you agree with that, Michael Franz?
That was my... this is Bill.
Bill, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Sunlight has been pushing for the Disclose Act or a version of it. I mean, I agree with Michael that it's absolutely critical for voters to have this information and for us to have it as a democracy. And I also kind of agree. I mean, it's the kind of thing that the public really needs to get behind. And I think that there's a possibility of that, happening, but it hasn't happened yet. And, with so much on the plate right now between, that Obama has said that immigration is a first priority. You've got the raising the debt ceiling. You've got the budget whole budget process. Mm-hmm. And, what are we going to do about spending? And this is the kind of issue that's very easy. And plus, of course, talking about different gun control proposals, this is the kind of issue that unfortunately gets pushed to the side. And I'm afraid that that's, happening right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit, Professor Franz, let's start with you, about where, how this money may buy some kind of influence. Is anybody keeping track of that? Are you keeping track of that? If you are given money, and nobody even knows who you are, but you're giving money, you're expecting something in return, I would imagine, or why in the world would you give huge amounts of money? What are you getting?
Whole ball game right here. I mean, it may not, this stuff may not influence or tip a significant amount of elections, as Bill's discussion of the research is suggesting initially, and we have more work to do on that. But what it might do is create an aura for big donors that they can't be ignored when they go to Capitol Hill. And so this is, we need more research on this. There's been a tremendous amount of research in political science that looks at the relationship between the traditional PAC money and legislative efforts, and that research has been somewhat mixed in terms of finding a significant effect. But those donations, the traditional PAC donations, are pretty small, $5,000 to a candidate for elections, per election. But the super PAC donations are unlimited, or donations to 501Cs are unlimited. And what a donor gets out of those massive donations, what a Sheldon Adelson gets for an $18 million donation, is unknown yet. But what they almost certainly get is significant access to powerful legislators.
Sure.
And whether or not that translates into policy is an open question. It probably has some influence on the way policy is structured or the agenda that gets set by legislative leaders. But this is what we need to be focusing on in our research in the next few years to establish that relationship, because this is the kind of thing that the Supreme Court said there was no evidence of when it made its judgment in Citizens United. But if the evidence suggests in coming years that there is a relationship between donors and policymaking, then it's possible that a Supreme Court newly constituted with new justices in the future could revisit this case and reestablish some restrictions.
Mm. Bill, are you looking at that? Is your research looking at that?
Yeah, and we don't take quite as a social science approach, but we have been looking at, so who are these big donors and who are the ones that gave, all this money to super PACs, and, have they gotten things? And I think, the classic example of this, it was really kind of funny because during the election, Paul Begala was talking about, the Democratic consultant that, well, the people that give to our super PACs are just, good Americans who care about the
right
process. And he talked about Jeffrey Katzenberg in particular, the head of the DreamWorks animation studio, as being an example of this. And he said it's not like he's going to sell more tickets to movies because he gave this $2 million. Well, no. He's not going to sell more tickets to movies, but he may get more money back when he does sell tickets. And there was an issue between the U.S. and China over how much U.S. companies or U.S. film producers would get reimbursed from the box office when they show their films in China. Joe Biden negotiated it with the Chinese vice president, his counterpart, when he was visiting the United States in 2011, sometime after Mr. Katzenberg had made this large donation. And an aide to Biden said that he was calling up Biden during the negotiations, or Biden was calling up Katzenberg during the negotiations to make sure that the numbers were okay with him.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the kind of thing that you get when you're the average citizen.
Right.
And,
right.
So I think that this really does show that, and again, I think that, it's absolutely true. It's access is the most important thing. They don't get everything that they want, but they do get that access to decision makers, and they do have the ability to try to influence, whether it's a trade negotiation, the writing of a tax bill, How much of a budget is going to go to, defense contractors. I mean, they get a seat at the table that the average person just never has access to.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls and emails and all of that for our guest now. Bill Allison, who was just speaking, editorial director of the Sunlight Foundation, reporting, and they are, as we have said, developing and encouraging new government policies to make it more open and transparent. We're also speaking with Professor Michael Franz, Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, tracking political ads in top races across the country. We're under the broad umbrella looking at many parts of what's happened in this country as a result of the Citizens United ruling. Senator Feingold earlier this hour called it one of the four or five worst decisions ever by the United States Supreme Court. Would you agree? What do you think about trying to get federal disclosure of who's giving money here? Do you think that somebody can run for office and not take this money and still win, make a statement, make a principled statement? Is that something that principled candidates need to do, or does everybody have to play this game until the Supreme Court changes? Is that what it will take? What do you think? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page, where we have the article that prompted this, all of this discussion, which is in the Democracy Journal. And that is on our Facebook page, too. Everyone's Fight is the name of the article. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have news coming up at 10 o'clock and then the second hour of our program. Tonight, the new season of Pioneers of Television, which will be featuring funny ladies of television, Carol Burnett and Mary Tyler Moore, and many others. We'll hear some of those clips. We'll be speaking with Mike Trinklein, who's a producer of Pioneers of Television on PBS, and that's going to be after the news at 10 o'clock. Okay, let's go to phone calls for both of our guests. 800-486-8655 is the number. Pat in Milwaukee is next. Is first for both of you.
I just have a question for your guest. I listened to the first half hour, and I may have missed it here. I missed part of the show in the second half hour. But it seems like the contributions of labor unions, both public and private sector, has been completely ignored in this segment. And to me, this has been the largest special interest in our elections in the past 30, 40 years, not the past 2 years since Citizens United. And corporate interests, they seem to go both ways. President Obama was actually the first candidate in 2008 to reject public financing of campaigns and take private financing. Since then, it's snowballed and it's gotten out of control. But why is there no discussion of the hundreds of millions of dollars in union dues that, let's be honest, are confiscated from employees' paychecks to pay for elections? And pay for one party, not another party. I think 96% of the union contributions go towards the Democratic Party. And to me, especially in the public sector, that is an inherent conflict of interest when you're paying the campaigns of the people that then get elected. And I'm just wondering, is there any discussion of that, or are we just talking about limiting groups like business, chamber, and commerce, while ignoring, the large masses of union donations that we've seen over the past 30, 40, 50 years?
All right, Pat, thanks for the call. Who wants to start?
Well, I can just really quickly, this is Mike Franz, I can really quickly just note that in our study, which is the focuses on television advertising, we have found in the last few years, just to focus on the post-Citizens United period, that there's been more money on television from pro-Republican organizations. But that doesn't mean that there isn't money from labor unions funneled through these other organizations, which does happen. You do see the American Federation of State county municipal employees advertising. They did that in the Wisconsin Senate race. You do see SEIU and AFL-CIO getting involved directly, but they also fund pro-democratic organizations that aren't that don't have a labor union name attached to them on the television ads themselves. But they're still being out-advertised by the conservative organizations like Crossroads, American Crossroads, Crossroads GPS, Restore Our Future, and so forth. What our data do not include, and what Bill's analysis of the FEC data is able to better include, is expenditures by unions that are not for television explicitly, but might be for member communication or voter mobilization. And unions do that a lot, and they do it for the Democratic Party. And this is one of the challenges in moving forward, is designing a law that can appeal to both Republican and Democratic members of Congress, that they don't feel disproportionately disadvantages one of the two constituencies, either business that benefits Republicans or labor that benefits Democrats. This is usually a stumbling block in the passage of legislation, because one side says that the other side isn't being treated the same. And so it's a fair point to talk about the role that labor plays both on the air and off the air. But at least in the data we have, we still see on TV pro-Republican organizations out advertising labor unions.
Thanks, Pat, for the call. Bill in Superior, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering how you gentlemen determine cause and effect. I think the Supreme Court ruling was terrible myself, but I could certainly see any law coming up, the wagging tongues on the radio decrying the fact that people who have a certain way of thinking can no longer support politicians who agree with them.
Bill, you want to take that?
I mean, I guess it's a little bit tough to, because obviously, I mean, you know, politicians are looking for the place where, looking for views that, people to follow them. I think that what we're interested in, though, is the extent to which these outside groups are, in some ways controlling the debate, trying to get their message out. I think it's much more effective in a congressional race or in a House race than it is in a presidential contest, where presidential campaigns have an awful lot of resources to get their own message out. And I think that, when you go further and further down the ballot, a lot of this outside money can have a huge impact. And a lot of times the things that these organizations are talking about have very little to do with the moneyed interests behind them. In other words, you have somebody like Sheldon Adelson, who may be very interested in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and you're seeing ads that talk about nothing but, how poor the economy is. So I think that that's really where the disconnect is, and I think that's where, the public is poorly served by a lot of these advertisements.
Senator Feingold, in that piece in Democracy, said, and he's a Democrat, so he mentioned Democrats. I want your response to this. Michael, let's start with you. Some will say that Democrats must embrace corrupt money to stay competitive, but the argument is both self-serving for politicians and unmoored to reality. Do you agree?
Well, I mean, I think the notion of, accepting corrupt money has its own little ambiguities wrapped up in that. But what I think he's suggesting is that Democrats don't need to play the same game as other big donors, or don't have to play the big donor game. They can
right.
rely on sort of voter mobilization. And I mean, I think that's true. I think that's true. It's true on both sides, but it's also true more today than really, potentially more true today than it's ever been. I mean, one of the ironies of this, as we talk about big money, is that we're also in an age of the internet, which allows for the mobilization of regular citizens in ways that were much more difficult at 20, 30, 40 years ago, where people couldn't connect as easily as they can today. One of the things that could stop the influence of big donors relatively quickly without congressional legislation is activation of regular citizens. If regular citizens get involved in campaigns, if they pressure their elected leaders and the candidates to support regular citizens and not wealthy interests, if they take a real care to figure out how they're going to vote and what individual legislators are going to do, then members of Congress and other candidates will calibrate their efforts towards those voters. To the extent that voters stay disengaged, aren't interested in politics, don't want to talk about issues, then it's easy for candidates to ignore those voters and to focus on the people that are interested, which can be disproportionately wealthy investors. And so I think, it's in the power of American citizens to counteract this case by becoming involved in the electoral process. And we oftentimes hear, just as a final point, you know, you shouldn't talk about politics and religion with your family. It may be the case with religion, but I think we need to be far more interactive with our neighbors and with our friends on the issues of politics, because that's the only mechanism that for sure can counteract the influence of big money.
Yeah, it makes for a great conversation, too. On that challenge, we will say goodbye to both of you, and thank you very much. We thank our guest, Senator Russ Feingold, the first part of the show, Michael Franz, Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, and Bill Allison, Editorial Director of Sunlight Foundation Reporting. Direct your attention to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where the article, which is worth reading, is there for you, and you will want to read it and think about it. What it has to say. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program. Thanks to you for your interest and calls.